Warning, Star Trek From the Holodeck contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended, do not continue to listen.
Lock it alone!
Fire.
Holodeck 3 program is reinstated.
Open sesame!
Commander Klingon vessel, we are energizing transporter beam. Now.
Welcome, everyone, to Star Trek From the Holodeck. I am the captain of this vessel, and I'm on the bridge with Ensign. Hold on a second. Yes, he is wearing a red skirt today. We're going back to the TNG days. Ensign David Sabal, hello.
It is very uncomfortable crossing my legs, Captain.
Well, who asked you to cross your legs?
I gotta let the boys breathe.
That would be crossing your legs, and that'd be opening your legs. That'd be spreading them.
Well, see, I'm crossing my legs right now.
Okay.
But I need to let the boys breathe.
All right. We're going to cut all that out. All right. So today, Dave, you and I have a very special show lined up. We are going to cover a graphic novel that's truly mesmerizing. It's beautiful, amazing, and any other positive adjective you want to throw in there, it'll work. Yeah. We are going to break down and discuss Harlan Ellison's City on the Edge of Forever. Yes, this was an episode on the original series.
Yes.
I believe it was episode 28.
And it's considered one of the best, if not the best, yes, Star Trek episode.
I believe it was episode 20 of the first season. And we're not going to be talking about the TV episode. We're going to be talking about the 2014 comic book adaptation. And you might ask, why do I care about reading an adaptation of a TOS episode? Because it's adapted from the original teleplay from 1967. It's different.
Very different.
It's a lot different. And are you ready, Dave? I would say it's more than just different. It's probably better. And that's saying a lot because the final episode, the actual episode itself is typically, as you mentioned, recognized as one of the best episodes of the entire original series of Star Trek. So I'm saying a comic book adaptation is better, everyone hold on. We're about to go to warp 10. I know that's not possible. Calm down, Trek fans. All types of weird shit happened, but we're going to go there today.
Yes, we are. And you know what? I'm actually with you on that. After reading the graphic novel, because I love the original episode. Original episode is absolute classic.
Yeah.
And it's one of the Star Trek episodes that I really enjoy because it, for me, took two different genres and put them into one, kind of like two different styles. The original Star Trek show and Twilight Zone, especially when you get to the twist of the whole episode in City in the whole with Kirk and Keller.
Right.
That twist, it ranks up there. It should belong up there for like classic television when you think of moments like the Twilight Zone episode.
And I think most people do hold this episode in high esteem. Even non-Trek fans, television aficionados, critics, they all look at this episode as a piece of, you know, a piece of historical achievement in terms of television, because it was ambitious. And even though the comic book is different, it still manages to capture the heart of the episode. But this is why it's better, because it does much more than that.
Yeah.
It doubles down on doubles down on the philosophy. It has moments of poetry, action, suspense, romance. It was a very human episode, but also is an even more human comic adaptation. And in terms of the TV show, many consider it William Shatner's best performance as Kirk.
I mean, like, if you watch all of the original series, everyone always makes fun of William Shatner's acting throughout the series. And it's kind of like a mainstay, right? But if you watch this episode, this is where William Shatner really went, you know, it's almost like he has a different vibe about him when he's given a very serious script.
Yeah, just side topic here. William Shatner is a very good actor. He does not get the credit that he deserves. There are moments, I'm not going to sit here and lie to you. There are moments where he hams it up, and he does that intentionally. But if you get the right director and the right script, he will deliver every single time. You just got to have more dominance. You got to be the alpha in that dynamic. You can't let him browbeat you. You have to be a powerful, assertive director and say, listen, William, calm the fuck down.
Yes.
And if you can do that, you're going to have a fantastic performance. Or that's why actors need directors, because they will guide them.
Or even take it even from the directing side to the writing side. I mean, the script itself for City on the Edge of Forever is, I know this is a very, very big statement for it, but it's a masterpiece script. If you look at like what Harlan Ellison, Gene Roddenberry, and DK Fontana was able to craft together as a writing team, it's amazing what you get. It may not be like the episode I know is not very popular with Harlan Ellison, because like what we're going to cover about like the graphic novel, it's very different from his original teleplay.
But very different.
It still has this tone from his original script that brings this like almost like this human drama to
it. They kept the message.
Yeah,
but I do, you know, upon retrospect, when you look back, I get why Harlan wasn't completely pleased, but also he understands that he's a very small cog in the machine when it comes to television entertainment. A writer is not going to have final say on his episode.
He's not.
So despite all of this and how great the actual episode is, I would say the comic adaptation is better. And we'll get into why I feel that way in just a minute. But Dave, give me your initial thoughts on the comic book in a nutshell.
My initial thoughts, the first time you ever brought this up, because you sent me a text about it
a couple months ago, and you had not read this,
and
right?
I had not read it.
Okay.
And there was a reason why I hadn't read it, is because the original episode is so classic and it's already as good as it is.
Yeah.
Usually adaptations don't do it justice. Yes, it's the original teleplay. That's what caught me when I read it and it said, oh, the original teleplay by Harlan Ellison. And so Roddenberry has not touched it. Fontana didn't touch it. This was all Harlan Ellison. And this was his original idea for the episode.
Right.
That's what caught me. Because I was like, okay, it's not going to be a straight adaptation from the original episode. This is actually his original script, which really intrigued me. And I approached it very hesitant because I was like going, how can you be better than that episode? How can you be better than that writing? And I read, I could not put it down once I started.
I told you, man.
I couldn't put it down.
I told you.
I opened the pages and the first couple of things, I'm like going, okay, this is interesting.
Exactly, man. Because I was simply looking for something to pass the time, and it had come up on my feed. Some Star Trek person I follow was talking about the top 10 Star Trek comic books of all time. We were talking about year 5, and then I saw him post some stuff, and this was, I believe, number one on his list. I'm like, really? An adaptation to a TV episode? I'm like, listen, those are fun sometimes, but it's not, how's that warrant number one? So I found it on Comixology. I have a Comixology subscription, and I was like, I'll just go through it for a second. The moment I opened it up, I read the whole thing straight through.
Yeah, I couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
There was no point where I would want to stop and basically say, okay, I'll come back to it. Like I usually do with a lot of comics, honestly, majority of comics, that's how it usually goes. This one, as soon as I started from page one, it held me throughout all of, and think about this. It's not just one issue. The collection itself is a collection of five separate issues.
Right.
So to actually hold your reader, especially someone like me, from page one all the way to issue five, that's impressive writing.
Yeah.
That is absolutely impressive writing. And the one thing that really surprised me too was I wasn't really excited about the team behind the comic, the Tiptons and the artist.
Yeah, that's the other thing too.
The artist,
we're not too keen on a lot of their work.
I wasn't keen on their work, and especially the artist. I knew him from the Mirror Universe
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you mentioned that off air, and I was like going, I really did not like his art in Star Trek, but here I don't know what happened, but
called a good script. When you have a good script, everything falls together. Everything comes together, I should say.
Yeah. His art in this reminds me of Alex Ross, where it's that painted,
yeah,
beautiful kind of gallery type of art that goes along with the script. And I don't know if that's just because, just like what you said, how good that script was.
I think there's a lot of passion, Dave, behind the project. I believe possibly J.K. Woodward and the Tiptons were probably very passionate about this project because of who Ellison is and the fact that this was based on his original script. It's famous. Everyone knows of this script. So I'm sure there's just so much passion that everyone just wanted it to do a pristine job from start to finish. All right, so let's get official here. Star Trek, Harlan Ellison's The City on the Edge of Forever is a five-issue comic book by IDW Publishing based on Harlan Ellison's teleplay for the Star Trek, the original series episode, The City on the Edge of Forever. The main cover art was done by Juan Ortiz in the same style as his Star Trek, The Art of Juan Ortiz art book. And I have to say, those covers, as well as the variants,
wow,
are also just gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
Just gorgeous work. Also, you can now get the collection, which was released on February 3rd of 2015. The series was also collected in the second volume of the Star Trek graphic novel collection in January 2017. All right, so the story behind the original screenplay, as we have alluded to, is very well documented. It was rejected because it created a lot of potential budgetary problems. There were elements included that were just not possible for this time in television. Ellison was possibly a little bit self-indulgent when he was writing this.
Yes.
But hey, all the best writers typically are a little self-indulgent. He had an ambitious idea, and it needed an ambitious script. And when you read the comic book, it's easy to see how Ellison's original draft is beyond what would have been possible, or I'd say conceivable for Trek at the time. I mean, come on, dude. I mean, I know you're a great writer, but are you just cut off from the world of TV? Did you really think that these types of things were possible? I mean, we were still, what, a decade away from the blockbuster films?
No, you're right. You're right.
I mean, these things just weren't being done. I mean, Star Trek was already revolutionary with the model work in so many ways. So we were about 10, 12 years away from the blockbuster golden age. We're about 10 years away or so from Star Wars. Things were not just easy to do.
Yeah.
And Ellison admits, and I think this is funny, David, there were some articles going around the internet kind of not bashing him, but saying that he should have known better. But Ellison admits in these issues here, because there's a foreword, there's also an afterword.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
He admits that he hadn't even watched an episode of Trek at that point. And he was working on an early production Bible. And there were people that were covering this comic book kind of laughing at that. I'm like, well, how'd you not watch an episode? I'm like, well, you gotta remember, a lot of these scripts were probably just being written by the writers. It doesn't mean they're watching every episode. I doubt more than 10 episodes were even out there yet for audiences to watch. This was the first season. This is the episode 28. So for him to say he hasn't had to watch an episode of Star Trek, it's not that mind blowing.
Yeah,
to think that. I mean, these are writers that are on season one of Trek. Now, if he had been hired for like season 5 of a TV show, he's all, yeah, I'm going to write an episode. Let's see here. Everyone sit back and wait for my magical glory to hit all of you and wow you. And then yet this dude has never watched a single episode of this said fictitious TV show I'm using as an analogy.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, that's laughable and he probably should be fired. But you're dealing with the 28th episode of season one when a lot of things are probably in production still. So it's not that strange. And also, yeah, he was going off an early production Bible, and a lot of people say that's probably the reason why the tone of the script was very different.
Yes.
Because he was going off concepts and characters that were changed for whatever reason. Executives wanted Yao Ming to be more sexy, to be more connected to William Shatner during the first season as a like love interest, on again, off again love interest.
Yeah.
Whereas in this comic book, she's more dressed as a leader of sorts. She had a more important role rather than just simply bringing coffee to Captain Kirk.
Yeah. It's literally
or rubbing his shoulders, which still to this day, just, I know it's the times, but I'm in the middle of rewatching again the original series. And there are moments in the first season where she just like,
cringe.
He's really stressed out, like Captain Kirk. So she comes up behind him and rubs his back. I'm like, that's just weird.
It's a different time, man. It is an absolute different time.
Yeah.
Because like, I was really impressed with how Ellison used the characters in a way that basically kind of made them look better than Roddenberry could ever do. Like
you're firing shots, Dave.
Honestly, Spock in this one, the interaction between Kirk and Spock actually gives their relationship more a better understanding.
Okay, let me back you up on this because I will agree. I feel like there is an attention to a friendship being built.
Yes.
Without having to worry about keeping people's attention on TV. You're not worried about those commercial breaks. You're not worried about the sleazy executive who's falling asleep and being bored while he's watching these episodes so he can give you his approval. It's not that Gene Roddenberry couldn't do it. It's that he was also running a business. Whereas Ellison is like, hey, I'm going to take all the fucking time I want to really flesh out these characters and build their relationship up in a way.
Because he's approaching it as a writer.
He is looking at it solely as a writer and not looking at it as a business and looking at it as a way to say, hey, I also have to make sure the mainstream is connecting with this and we're keeping our eyes open for those commercial breaks, for those beats.
Yeah.
So I would agree there is a more nuanced. And again, that's saying a lot, Dave, because we already know the relationship between Spock and Kirk and McCoy is some of the greatest.
Yeah.
Even in the first season. But I will say there's a more nuanced approach to it in this original teleplay.
And, you know, let's get this out of the way. The biggest difference in this one is McCoy's not even in it. In the original episode, McCoy is kind of like an important role in it.
Yeah.
Here, he's not even in it. Ellison's original play, he chose characters for a specific reason. And that's the thing that I noticed is like the characters that are here are not wasted. You know, they're not just background people.
Well, if you don't need them, then they're not there.
Yeah.
Again, remembering contracts and
stuff
and TV contracts. Hey, so-and-so George Takei is contracted to be in 17 episodes this year. So we need to make sure he's here. Ellison wasn't bothered. He wouldn't be bothered by any of that shit.
He didn't give two shits about that. All he cared about is
telling a story
and what his story is about. Even, I mean, the overall message in his script is what drives his writing. It's not the characters even. I mean, if you were to take this teleplay, remove the characters like Kirk and Spock and Yeoman and just put any characters in there, this is still a really nice classic story that you read about. Well, a sci-fi story.
Yeah, because that's where he made his bones. So just to give a little more background on Harlan Ellison, he was one of the first writers actually recruited by Gene Roddenberry for Star Trek. Roddenberry was aiming to have the best science fiction writers produce scripts for the show and had identified Ellison immediately. At the time, Ellison had been nominated for the 1965 Writers Guild of America Award for Outstanding Script for a Television Anthology with his script for the Outer Limits episode, Demon with a Glass Hand. Yep. He went on to win. Rather than being assigned a pre-written premise, Ellison was actually allowed, because of his big swingin' dick status, to develop his own and propose it in a 10-page outline. Ellison was inspired by reading a biography of the evangelist Amy Semple McPherson and thought that it would be an interesting idea to have Kirk travel back in time and fall in love with a similar woman of good intent, but someone who must die in order to preserve the future. Ellison considered that it would have a heartrending effect on Kirk. And this is where the comic book and the episode both succeeded. It did wonders for the development of Captain Kirk.
Yes.
They got to the same. This is why I applaud both Roddenberry and Ellison, because they both got to the same point, just different ways.
Yes.
One took this route, the other took the other route. But at the end of the day, you still had what was the most important, and that was developing our protagonist, Captain Kirk.
Captain Kirk.
In a way that up to this point in the first season, we had not seen. But this comic managed to bring an element, and this is where I feel like it does better. It managed to bring an element of tragic romance through visual that even the episode wasn't completely able to do this well. It did do it. But yeah, not as good as this. At the core of this comic, you have an epic poem written around an idea about forbidden love, lost love, a love that should never have been. It's tragically beautiful. And even though you can see it coming from a mile away, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make it hurt any less.
Yeah.
And the artist, J.K. Woodward, who typically you and I both aren't the biggest fans of his work. And yet in this comic, he managed to isolate sequences that were purposely highlighted to convey the idea of a poetic aesthetic. Just like a cinematographer does with television and film, Woodward took artistic liberties to paint a picture with, I guess you could say, a nuanced poetic vignette. He isolated key moments with his visuals. There are, yes, scenes where Kirk and Spock are talking about being outsiders, you know, being aliens on this world. And suddenly the background is just dropped into darkness. And he paints this picture, this vignette of them isolated. And when Spock and Kirk are arguing, they are separated by darkness. and they are encompassed by a shroud of shadow. It's very intelligent. I have, despite not being the biggest fan of Woodward, I have read a lot of his work, or I should say read comic books where he was the artist, because he works a lot on Star Trek comics, and I like Star Trek, obviously, and I'm just not always all about it. I get tired of some of his art, and yet here, I don't know what it was, maybe just everything coming together and just working. It was beautiful. It was amazing. The artwork, even at times, resembled Drew Struzan at his best.
Yeah.
He's that classic go-to movie poster artist back in the day that did some of the most famous and iconic posters for some of the best films of the era. Indiana Jones, Star Wars, just to name a few. And there's numerous panels where reflections are used to serve as a reminder to the reader that Kirk and Spock are mere reflections of a future that no longer exists.
Yeah.
So it's highly intelligent. There's a lot of thought. There's things that they were able to do in this comic book that cinematographers in the 60s weren't allowed to do, because you're not about to be experimental on a CBS show in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
There just isn't time or room for that. This is pre-golden age of TV.
This is basically camera one, camera two, camera three. That's all you got.
Yeah.
There's nothing fancy.
No, and there were philosophical portraits painted about the importance of life. And this is my favorite. These are my favorite moments of the comic book. Weighing the cost of life opposed to the life of people that were never born. The needs of the many, that'll go too.
Yes.
There's an understanding of Trek here that I find very peculiar, because Ellison did not watch Star Trek, right?
Yes.
And yet there's an understanding of Trek at its core.
Yeah, here, there is.
Which makes me wonder, is this the very episode of Star Trek that really helped pave the way for what Trek would actually end up becoming?
That's something that a lot of Trek fans say. That's why that this particular episode is so important and so revered, is because this is the culmination. This is the apex of what Star Trek storytelling is all about.
And maybe Roddenberry, you know, reviewed this script. He's all like,
this is damn good.
This is pretty close to how I wanted my series to be. There, I'm going to change a few things, but I like this. I like that, because this seems to be the cornerstone of Star Trek. Episode 28 of the TV show is really the moment when Star Trek, in my opinion, comes together. And yeah, this comic book doubles down on that feeling, on that tone.
And it becomes more than just a sci-fi kids show. You know, because beforehand, when Star Trek was out in their first season, that's what it was actually marketed as, was a Star Trek kids show. That's the honest to God truth. It's a sci-fi show.
I think a lot of people didn't take it seriously,
and
because
no one took it seriously.
It's science fiction. You know, at that time, people were like, whoa, space travel.
But the thing that, when I read this graphic novel, what really impressed me was Harlan Ellison was able to do what we all as Trek fans love in our stories when it comes to Star Trek, but he was actually ramp it up to 11. Like, yeah, like you were saying about like dealing with that philosophy of the needs of the many. Not only does he do that, but then he stacks it with other philosophy questions, stuff about race.
Yeah.
When Kirk basically, at one moment, Spock turns to him, and I think it was that moment that you were talking about, how Woodward was able to capture visually this discussion of philosophy between Kirk and Spock, as it's black and white with a void of black between them discussing about why why Keller has to die. But on top of that, Kirk telling Spock that basically, oh, you don't understand because you're not human. And then Spock turns around and tells him, I may not be fully human, but I'm half human. So yes, I can understand, but I'm also not capable of showing that.
Yeah, he's still a part of an empathic race. I mean, yeah, just because they repress
race,
just because they repress their emotions doesn't mean he doesn't understand and get it.
And you have this moment when Kirk kind of stops and says, and Woodward did a fantastic job showing like almost like the facial reactions to the characters that you would imagine that if it was Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, this is how they would act towards each other as characters. Like Kirk actually stops and has this look like, oh, I'm sorry. I overstepped my bounds. I said something that was very cruel. Because he was essentially being racist towards Spock, because calling him that you don't understand because you're not human.
Yeah, well, and that's that. I'm glad you picked up on that, because that part, I thought it was very interesting. And maybe it's almost like, hey, you don't belong here. This isn't your time. Look what's happening. Like, because you're staying here too long, you are becoming what your species, the human race, used to be. You're adopting their ideas, their ideology. Dude, it's pretty powerful stuff. Something that Gene Roddenberry took out.
Yeah.
There wasn't in the TV episode, obviously everyone has watched it, there aren't those moments of racism. He removed those elements for whatever political reasons. I have some notes on that that we'll get into towards the end of the show. But again, it shows you just how much of a thinker Ellison is. He's putting all types of things in here.
He's putting
thoughts on racism, thoughts on the greater good, the needs of the many. There are just so many things going on that Ellison wanted to put into the script. I mean, okay, we need to slow down just a second, but also just to isolate this one moment here, something I have mentioned a couple times now, but okay, so thoughts on tragic love that should never have been, right?
Yes.
Okay. In order for human civilization to reach its pinnacle of enlightenment, a woman who's too progressive.
Yes.
She has arrived at a certain type of evolutionary state too soon. Right?
Yes.
Okay.
Essentially.
And because of that, because she has a way of thinking that's not aligned with the world, she has to die.
Yes.
Because she may change the way things happen. She's supposed to die. And if she lives, humans won't go through the bumps and bruises they need to in order to reach the future that was meant to be.
Because she would actually.
How fucked is that?
That is one of the things that made this such a cool tragedy, because in essence, Keller is the ultimate, you can almost say she's like the messiah.
She's a martyr.
She's a martyr because she's the perfect being. She's what we all have to strive for, because essentially her whole character is based around pacifism and understanding and tolerance. And it's in a time when that basically is not used right now.
Is that fucked up when you think about it?
Yeah.
Hey, listen, you're too good.
You're too good.
You're about 300 years too early. You're going to have to die, because if you start changing the way people think, the Germans may end up winning World War II.
Exactly.
Because time is delicate. And that's another fucking message. I mean, Ellison is a fucking introspective motherfucker. I mean, the fact that he even has thoughts on time and refers time to a river that flows and that one ripple can change everything. And
the butterfly effect.
Dude,
he's essentially talking about the butterfly effect.
Yeah, it is so good. And yes, the TV episode did breeze through some of these things, but not at the same maturity level as this comic book adaptation.
Yeah.
It just did not.
And think about it. Essentially, the argument of Keller is the exact opposite of like the stereotypical one that everyone constantly says when it comes to time travel stories. Would you go back in time and kill baby Hitler?
Would you go back in time and kill a good person?
Would you go back in time and kill a good person instead?
Yeah.
So reading this really opened my eyes into how you layer so many things, because Ellison was able to actually layer all these political thoughts not heavy handed.
It wasn't because if someone were to put down on a list of, you know, on a piece of paper, the list of things that this comic book has, you'd be like, Jesus Christ, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
It's going to be too overstuffed. But no, everything flows and everything works hand in hand.
It is an absolute masterwork of actually looking how to write. Because when I read this, I read this about 15 times to actually see how the script actually forms and stuff, like with throughout all the dialogue and everything. Dude, what Ellison was able to weave, this needs to be studied for writing purposes, for writers everywhere out there, because he was able to do essentially what every single writer has tried to do, and me and you have always stated, majority of the time fail at political writing.
Yeah.
Soapboxing.
Yep.
Trying to make that writing work. He was able to do that not just with one political statement.
Because this isn't soapboxing. You know what this is? This is someone who understands the core of human culture.
This is an example of introspective writing.
Yeah. Okay. And just to further that, the villain and the plot device in the comic book is way better, in my opinion.
Yes.
I mean, so in the TV show, I always thought it was a little hokey. I mean, Dr. McCoy accidentally overdoses.
Well, you know, someone's not piloting the Enterprise properly.
Yeah. So that part, fine. You know, it's this show in the 60s.
Yeah.
I'll give it a pass. But the original script is far better, but I do get why Roddenberry removed it. It's a little too dark. It's about a drug addict Starfleet officer
who
was sentenced to murder or sentenced to death. That's a little goes against Roddenberry's core ideals
for Star Trek.
However, I think you could have made it work. But that's a topic for another time. But the villain, I feel, being essentially just a plot device, did work much better for this. You have a guy that's evil. And then right before this woman's death, we get another setup for another philosophical statement about good actions made by an evil person and evil actions made by a good person. In fact, the exact quote, because Spock is curious as to why this person who is bad, why did he try to save the woman from being hit by the car? And Kirk says, without knowing why, without even thinking of it, the worst among us does the great thing, the noble deed, that spark of impossible human godliness. Evil can come from good. And good from evil.
Good from evil, yeah. Because if you think about it, Kirk had to make the really tough decision of letting a person die, and that's an evil decision.
It really not a good decision. But again, what do you do? What's the alternative? History changes. And maybe I'm just emotional in my older age. I don't know if I'm a little too sensitive, but that last page where Kirk says, but I loved her. And Spock says, no woman was ever loved as much because no woman was ever offered the universe for love. Jesus
Christ, dude, Everyone talks about the ending of the original episode.
This is poetry, dude.
Yeah, this is poetry. And you take it into contrast of the original, where it's a very powerful moment when Kirk literally just says, let's get the hell out of here. Because of how tormented he is by this decision that he just made. The way the comic ends is so much more impactful.
I know.
It really is. And I can understand that it probably wasn't chosen because, you know, certain political moments, probably people looked at it and said, you know what, we don't want Spock to have the final say, the final word. We want Captain Kirk to have the final word. I could see that happening back in the 60s, and especially during those production times. So I can understand it. They made a good decision. Don't get me wrong. I still love the episode.
The episode's great, but
this ending?
There's an argument to be made.
Yes.
And we're making it that this comic book is better, than the original episode. And the original episode is some of the greatest Trek.
If not the greatest.
I mean, to me, this comic book, Dave, and I'm not overblowing it here, I think this is a masterpiece.
It is.
Forget the word Star Trek. Take Star Trek out of it. Remove the science. No, don't remove the science fiction element. Remove Star Trek, the Star Trek element. And you're telling a story about two guys traveling, two friends who travel back in time to allow a woman to die so that the future can be preserved. That's a story.
That's a story.
I mean, it's awesome. And
The funny part is it makes my brain think the ability to be able to see Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner act out the scene.
Deep fakes. Deep
this fake, would be Dave. Awesome.
Deep fake. Let you and I let's do it. Let's get the script and we'll use that new app for the iPhone where we do deep fake and I'll put Kirk's face over me and you could be Spock. And we'll just act it out.
Especially like when you take
you're just going to breeze right past that.
I would. I'm not going to actually argue with that one. Are you kidding me? I would do that in a heartbeat just because in two pages, I think it is two pages. It's an absolute. If I was an actor and I was looking at this as a storyboard.
Yeah.
And then you read the script. I would cream myself because Jesus, I'm
David,
like going
family show.
I get to do this. I get to act this. Are you kidding me? And a lot of actors would die to do something as dramatic as this. Now, the question becomes, do we think that William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy could do it?
Oh, maybe. Come on. No, yeah. They can't. Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner are both very accomplished actors. They just weren't given the best scripts at times,
but
I feel like they're very good. So let's go ahead though and take a quick break. And then when we get back, we're going to finish up our discussion here. We'll be right back.
Cry havoc and let's slip the dogs of war.
Everything!
Keep Rayman Digital on the air by pledging to our Patreon page. Your continued support allows us to continue to make great content and offer even better features in the future. Help us keep the lights on in the studio by pledging $1 to $10 a month. Go to patreon.com/RainmanDigital to pledge.
Free stuff is awesome, but free stuff that will spice up your bedroom is even better. Just go to adamandeve.com and select almost any one item for 50% off, and then we'll load on the free stuff. Just enter this very exclusive code, RAINMAN, at checkout, and you'll get 10 tantalizing free gifts, including a sexy item for him, a special toy for her.
Ooh.
And a third item you'll both enjoy.
Ooh.
And six extra special bonus items that are sure to rev your engine, pique your curiosity, and even blow you away. Plus,
Free shipping.
Always sent in discreet packaging. Go to adamandeve.com now. Get 50% off plus the 10 free gifts when you enter the exclusive offer code RAINMAN. Again, that's RAINMAN. Because without it,
no free stuff.
That's RAINMAN at adamandeve.com.
Space, the final frontier.
All right, welcome back, everyone, to Star Trek from the Holodeck. And don't forget to leave us reviews on iTunes and Stitcher. Give us thumbs up, share our show, and you can find all of our shows on demand on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Also, we offer a Patreon exclusive show. So if you want to get more Star Trek from the Holodeck, if you're really into our discussions and you want to help us stay on the air, it's the only real stream of revenue we have coming into the network. That's at Patreon. So patreon.com/RainmanDigital and pledge $5 or more a month. All right. So we had mentioned the tone a couple times.
Yeah.
And how different they are.
Very different.
Between the episode and the comic book. The overall tone of the piece is more adult, I would say. I think that's a good way of describing it than the, not just this episode, but even more so than the average Trek episode. And that's possibly why this episode adaptation probably holds up, because obviously we have matured in our taste of TV over the course of, what, several decades?
Yeah.
And although this particular installment sticks out as a Trek outing very light on cheese and heavy on drama, it still works and still feels a lot like Star Trek. There's no joking around in this version. There's no light witticisms. Kirk is serious, and so is everyone else.
Yes.
As we had mentioned, there is not a lot of supporting cast. So if you weren't essential to the story, you weren't there.
Yeah.
So other than Kirk and Spock and Rand, there were no other familiar characters. There's no Sulu, no Scotty, no McCoy, no Uhura.
It's bare bones.
And I'm okay with that, because we don't always say, listen, they're somewhere else in the ship. It's just not important for this particular story. The story was about Kirk and Spock and several cultural statements.
Yeah.
The Guardians speak some of the same lines we are familiar with from the TV version, featuring only a single set, but an effective abstract shape playing the Guardian, a choice that seems, I mean, according to various reports and people who've blogged over the course of, I don't know, 15 years or so, they say it's equally effective, just different. But I don't know. I mean, having the timekeepers or the guardians stand at the forefront of a city in front of a portal that leads to other time, I mean, it has a feel. I mean, I challenge anyone to watch some of the classic Greek epics from the 60s and 70s, The Clash of the Titans, or even read some epics, some of the Greek epics. And this is a scene from those epics.
Yeah, it's otherworldly. It's,
yes.
It has this gravitas to it.
Yeah, and the episode of television, yes, it was great for that time, but side-by-side comparison, this just conveys an entirely different
tone. vibe. and tone. Because, like, if for those that basically need a refresher on the original episode, if you look at the sets, they're very dated.
Well, of course, it's Star Trek, the original series.
And For one thing, the portal is just a gigantic rock with a
portal
with the center cut out.
Well, it's not.
That's it.
So it's not like our student films where the portal is just a flashing light.
Just a flashing light. I mean, the one image, dude, of when they initially say a city on the edge of forever. And suddenly you see like these like stalactites, these gigantic spikes.
It's so good.
And then in the just blended in is like this fortress on top of all these like mountains.
Yeah.
It's it has kind of like that, like what you said, that Greek god Mount Olympus type of feel.
Yeah, it's great, dude. Another change, and I believe we mentioned this earlier on. There was a change in the overall motif. Cynicism versus optimism. Roddenberry, of course, imagined a world without drug abuse.
Yes.
I mean, that's why, of course, we didn't have McCoy in this comic book, but we had McCoy accidentally inject himself rather than a drug addict do so on purpose. He also imagined and wanted to present a world without racism. And I guess apparently that stretched into the revising the past or revisiting the past, as he wasn't about to show real tolerance, which I have to question that if you're because they did talk about our past and that we learned from our past various times throughout the series. So oh, I don't know. Again, this last two sentences I'm reading from a blogger. I'll post his link within the podcast description so you can read his entire thoughts if you want to. But I don't know if I agree with that, if that's the reason why Roddenberry took it out, because, you know, he didn't want to show it for whatever reason in the past, which just wouldn't make sense. I feel like it's his second thought, which is has more to do with the fact that this is 1967 and there was already racial tension
at this time, at that moment.
And also the Vietnam War, and possibly the TV execs didn't want more realism. They wanted some true escapism.
Because you got to remember, I think a lot of people forget that when the original series was made, and I stated this early in the show, it was made to be a kid's show. It was made to be...
I wouldn't say it was made to be a kid show.
It was supposed to be a family show.
Yeah.
That's probably a better way of saying it. It was designed to be a family show that would go alongside shows like, you know, Gilligan's Island, Lost in Space.
Leave It to Beaver.
Leave It to Beaver. I Love Lucy. All those things were supposed to have.
Dream of Jeannie. Oh,
oh, I Dream of Jeannie. Jeez, I used to treat. Well, I
bet
still
you
do.
Kirk would have banged her.
Oh, instantly. He would hop into that bottle.
He would have fucked the bottle.
but I can understand why Roddenberry probably pulled back.
I mean, I understand. I get it.
And it leads into the thing that one of the articles I read about Ellison, that he actually called Gene Roddenberry a sellout. It was in an interview that he
they fought a lot.
They fought a lot, and Ellison used the term, hey, you're a sellout, a corporate sellout. And like, you don't think about that as Gene Roddenberry. Gene Roddenberry was very liberal when you think about it.
Yeah, but as I said, he's also in charge of a TV show.
He's in charge of a TV show.
He's wearing more than one hat. He's playing creative and also executive. That's how it is. And he was able to walk that line sometimes. Although there are various stories where he went head to head with executives as well because he wanted to do something. That's just the way of the beast. I mean, yeah. you've got to, if you're a showrunner for a TV show, you're going to have to learn how to play.
You have to learn how to play in the sandbox that you're in.
Yeah. Or you can just pee in it and make everyone mad.
Well, dude, my favorite quote, like I told you earlier, I pulled quotes of Harlan Ellison. Ellison actually, at one point when he was asked about Gene Roddenberry and his time on Star Trek, Ellison basically says,
oh, Jesus.
What was that?
Me being stupid.
Oh, he basically said every thug and studio putz and semi-illiterate bandwagon jumper and merchandiser has grown fat as a maggot in a corpse Jesus. Off of what I created.
Oh, he's amazing.
And I'm like, that's Harlan Ellison.
I like that guy.
I know.
Yeah. All right. So let's move into our final thoughts. We got to wrap. Dave, why don't you give me your final thoughts in 30 seconds or less and your RMD score. Go.
I'm going to start with my RMD score. This should be no shock after hearing me gush about this. It's 100. It's a must. Any Star Trek fan out there, go buy the collection. You will see. Read this, and you will leave the book afterwards going, wow.
Yeah, it's good. I will drop the links in our podcast description. So if you want to purchase those.
And honestly, we didn't even bring up one of my favorite parts of the story itself was not only did they tackle the whole effect of Keller, but the whole question of, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Well, the whole story between Kirk and the cripple, and basically referring to the cripple's sacrifice as negligible.
Well, that's what I was saying, how it was a thought he was trying to pose on the importance of life. It wasn't just about the woman, but if you remember, he wasn't as relevant. But when Kirk said to the Guardians, was his life not important? And they said, no, important, just not as relevant.
As relevant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was like going, wow. Okay. And when you get to that, again, it just shows how well Ellison was able to layer so many philosophical thoughts without feeling too jumbled, without feeling heavy-handed. It's a masterwork. It should be something that writers should look at and say, I want to try to do a story like this.
Uh-huh. For sure. I agree, man. So 100% from you.
100.
All right, I'm going to follow you up with a 100% as well. And typically, we don't agree on everything we don't agree on everything being 100 usually. Usually, I want to throw things at you. But yeah, this is 100%.
Well, dude.
This is Star Trek through and through.
Yeah.
I feel like this version of Star Trek is more aligned with more contemporary Star Trek. And when I mean contemporary, I mean the 90s. The 2000s.
I think so.
I think Ellison might have just been ahead of his time, but that's why I say, what if this episode is what actually paved the road to where we eventually got with Trek? It would make sense.
Yeah.
Because even though he never watched another episode, he was kind of like, fuck you, I'm going to do whatever I want. For some reason, this feels more like Trek than Trek.
Than Trek.
So... all right. Well, this does conclude our discussion. I want to thank everybody for listening. Please head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/Rainman Digital. Pledge $5 or more a month and gain access to more Star Trek from the holodeck discussions. We have thousands of hours over there. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Live long and prosper.
I couldn't help but notice your pain.
My pain?
It runs deep. Share it with me.
End simulation.